with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its scenes while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still. Dreams I walked alone, narrow streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp. I turned my collar to the cold and damp, when my eyes were stemmed by the flash of a neon light that split the night and touched the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more, people talking without speaking, people hearing.
People bow and pray to the neon guides. The neon guides that they made. I feel that this is what we face in this nation today. And in fact, around the world. Good evening. Welcome to a Thursday night installment of The Edge of Darkness. Jeffrey Bennett here for the next hour. And I promise you this will be a somewhat unusual hour. But before we begin, I, in effect, had an extremely good sleep last night. I woke up this morning, I took my morning meds, and I decided I just didn't want to be up, so I went and laid back down. And at 7:30 this morning, my phone rang, and normally I just wouldn't answer it, but I did. Dylan, I'd never spoken with before. I don't believe he's a listener. He first and foremost asked the question, is this Gold Star Trust Company? I said, no, it's not, sir. I said, I am a vendor who works closely with them and have for over 30 years. And he began to ask some questions. And I was in a guttural fog, and I said, look, what part of the country do you live in? He says, Florida. I said, I'm in Arizona, but at this time of the year, we're on daylight savings. We're 3 hours different. It's very early. I'm just barely waking up. May I call you back a bit later? He said, yes, please do. I did not wake up for 4 more hours. And I've been in kind of a funky place all day today. So I never had a chance to call the man back, and I'm going to have to do it in the morning and apologize to him and If he has found someone else to handle his needs, I understand that. But it's what we're going through. Stuff, my friends, stuff. There are times that I'm not quite sure what to do. Now, that may sound very unusual to you. There are three authors in particular that do a lot with me. Charles Dickens, of course, and I spoke with Charles today, as we do every day. My friend Justin O. Smith, who I've not heard from in over a week, and I've been concerned. So I touched bases with him today. He's doing fine. He got sidetracked with some things he had to do, but he was... Thanks for the concern that I passed out to him. My friend Al Benson, who, as many of you know, I had come to the conclusion roughly a year ago this week that Al had passed away. And then all of a sudden he came back into my life, and I thank God for it. He writes a tremendous amount regarding the education system and other issues, but that's the area that I'm concentrating most on, except that maybe later tonight I've got a two-part piece that he wrote. He wrote it as two separate articles. I'm going to combine it into one that I will post in a section on Federal Observer that's referred to as Sunset Boulevard. Sunset Boulevard basically is a area where we use old film titles or film-related articles that have kind of come back to haunt us. It's quite an interesting story. I can't wait to share it with you. There's another author who I've never met, I've never spoken with, but I have the utmost respect for this man. John Whitehead, Rutherford Institute. And normally, at least once a week, I will share his latest commentary, and this particular one hit me. Death of privacy. Philip K. Dick opens up this column tonight saying that there are no private lives. This, a most important aspect of modern life. One of the biggest transformation we have seen in our society is the diminution of the sphere of the private. And we must reasonably now all regard the fact that there are no secrets and nothing is private. Everything is public. Whitehead begins by stating that very factor. There is nothing private any longer. We teeter on the cusp of a cultural, technological, societal revolution, the likes of which have never been seen before. And while the political left and right continue to make abortion the face of the debate over the right to privacy in America, the government and its corporate partners, aided by rapidly advancing technology, are reshaping the world into one which there is no privacy at all. Nothing that was once private, my friends, is protected any longer. We've not even begun to register the fallout from the tsunami bearing down upon us in the form of AI, artificial intelligence, surveillance. And yet it is already reorienting our world into one in which freedom is almost unrecognizable. AI surveillance harnesses the power of artificial intelligence and widespread surveillance technology to do what the police state lacks the manpower and resources to do efficiently or effectively. They cannot be everywhere. Watch everyone and everything. They cannot monitor, identify, catalog, cross-check, cross-reference, nor collude. Everything that was once private in our lives is now up for grabs to the right buyer. governments and corporations alike have heedlessly adopted AI surveillance technologies with no care or concern for their long-term impact on the rights of the citizenry, the rights of humanity. As a special report by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace recently warned, a growing number of states are deploying advanced AI surveillance tools to monitor, track, and surveil citizens to accomplish a range of policy objectives, some lawful, but others that violate human rights, and many of which fall into a murky middle ground. Indeed, with every new AI surveillance technology that is adopted and deployed with no regard for privacy, Fourth Amendment rights, or due process, the rights of you and I, the citizenry, are being marginalized, undermined, eviscerated. Cue the rise of digital authoritarianism. And digital authoritarianism, as the Center for Strategic and International Studies cautions, involves the use of information technology to surveil, to repress, and manipulate the populace, endangering our human rights and civil liberties, and co-opting and corrupting the foundational principles of democratic and open societies, including freedom of movement, the right to speak freely, to express political dissent, and the right to personal privacy online and off. The seeds of digital authoritarianism were planted in the wake of the 9/11 attacks with the passage of the USA Patriot Act, a massive 342-page wish list of expanded powers for the FBI, the CIA, and the Patriot Act justified broader domestic surveillance. The logic being that if government agents knew more about each American, they could distinguish the terrorists from law-abiding citizens. Well, it all sounds good, but we've got too damn many of them being able to walk across the border and stay. The USA Patriot Act sounded the death knell for the freedoms enshrined in the Bill of Rights, especially the Fourth Amendment. And it normalized the government's mass surveillance powers. Writing for the New York Times, Jeffrey Rosen observed that, quote, before September 11th, the idea that Americans would voluntarily agree to live their lives under the gaze of a network of biometric surveillance cameras, peering at them in government buildings, shopping malls, subways, stadiums, would have seemed unthinkable. A dystopian fantasy of society that had surrendered privacy and anonymity. Who could have predicted that 50 years after George Orwell typed the final words to his dystopian novel, 1984, he loved Big Brother. We would come to love Big Brother. And yet, my friends, that is exactly what has come to pass. Oh, me, I've not come to love Big Brother. I've come to mistrust Big Brother, to dislike, to hate Big Brother. Those are my words, my friends. Well, after 9/11, Rosen found that people were happy to give up their privacy without experiencing a corresponding increase in security. More concerned about feeling safe than actually being safe. They demanded the construction of vast technological architectures of surveillance, even though the most empirical studies suggested that the proliferation of surveillance cameras had no effect on violent crime or terrorism. And so in the decades following 9/11, a massive security industrial complex arose that was fixated on militarization, surveillance, repression. But keep in mind, my friends, surveillance is the key. And we were being watched everywhere we go. Speed cameras, red light cameras. How many times have we talked about that on this program? Police body cameras now. Cameras on public transportation. Cameras in stores. Cameras on public utility poles. Cameras in cars. Cameras in hospitals and schools. Cameras in airports. Like it or not, my friends, we are being recorded at least 50 times per day. And it is estimated that there are upwards of 85 million surveillance cameras in the United States alone, second only to China. And on any given day, the average American going about his daily business and is monitored and surveilled, spied on, tracked on in more than 20 different ways by both government and corporate eyes and ears. I've got cameras on my computer. You think I'm being watched right now? I stick my finger up your nose. We must beware of what we say, what we read, what we write, where we go, and with whom you communicate, because it will all be recorded, stored, used against you eventually at a time and a place of the government's choosing. It's not just what we say. It's where we go, what we buy. All of this is being tracked. We're being surveilled right down to our very genes. And I'm not talking about Levi's. I'm talking about our internal, G-E-N-E-S. All of this thanks to a potent combination of hardware, software, data collection that scans our biometrics, our faces, irises, voices, genetics, microbiomes, scent. Yes, the way we smell, the gait, the way we walk, our heartbeat, our breathing, our behaviors. All of this runs through computer programs that can break the data down into unique identifiers and then offers them up to the government and its corporate allies for their respective uses. As one AI surveillance advocate proclaimed, surveillance is no longer a watchful eye, but a predictive one as well. Example. Emotion AI, an emerging technology that is gaining in popularity, uses facial recognition technology to analyze expressions based upon a person's face print to detect our intentional emotions or feelings, our motivations, our attitudes. And China claims that AI surveillance can already read facial expressions in brain waves in order to determine the extent to which members of the public are grateful, obedient, and willing to comply with the Communist Party. That, my friends, is the slippery slope that leads to the thought police. And the technology is already being used by border guards to detect threats at border checkpoints, as an aid for detection and diagnosis of patients for mood disorders, to monitor classrooms for boredom or disruption, and to monitor human behavior during video calls. The technology allows them to monitor classrooms for boredom. Oh, those would be the students that would be designated as ADHD and put on prescription drugs to control the way they are because they are bored out of their minds with the crap that's going on in the education system in this nation today. My friends, for all intents and purposes, we now have a fourth branch of government. It is the surveillance state. And the fourth branch came into being without any electoral mandate or constitutional referendum. And yet it possesses superpowers above and beyond those of any other government agency except the military. And let's face it, most of our military is stationed overseas. This These powers are all-knowing, they're all-seeing, they're all-powerful. The fourth branch operates beyond the reach of the president and Congress and the courts, marches in lockstep with the corporate elite who really call the shots in D.C. It's not Clown Joey that's calling any shots in D.C. Oh, did you hear? It came out today. Apparently, Joey's got COVID. Or does he have a reoccurrence of his cancer? Doesn't matter. He's not calling the shots. You see, the government's techno-tyranny surveillance apparatus has become so entrenched and entangled with this police state apparatus that it's hard to know anymore where law enforcement ends and surveillance begins. The short answer? They have become one and the same entity. The police state has passed the baton to the surveillance state, which has shifted into high gear with the help of artificial intelligence technologies. And the COVID-19 pandemic helped to further centralize digital power in the hands of the government at the expense of the citizens' private rights. Now we've got it going on now that COVID is tracked all the way down to the babies and the youth of our nation. They're all being vaccinated. For those of you who are out spying on me tonight, you sons of bitches, I have yet to be vaccinated. Not since May the 28th of 1968. You show up at my door with a needle, one of us is going to get shot first. Those are my words, not the author's. And so consider this. From cameras that identify the faces of passerbys to algorithms that keep tabs on public sentiment online, artificial intelligence or AI-powered tools are opening new frontiers in state surveillance around the world. And though begins the Carnegie Endowment's report on AI surveillance notes. And they continue by saying law enforcement, national security, criminal justice, and border management organizations in every region are relying on these technologies, which use statistical pattern recognition, machine learning, big data analytics, all to monitor citizens. And in the hands of tyrants and benevolent dictators alike, AI surveillance is the ultimate means of repression and control, especially through the use of smart city, safe city platforms, facial recognition systems, and predictive policing. Predictive policing? These technologies are also being used by violent extremist groups, as well as sex, child, drug, and arms traffickers for their own nefarious purposes. And China, the role model for our dystopian future, has been a major force in deploying AI surveillance on its own citizens, especially by way of its social credit systems, which it employs to identify, track, segregate its good citizens from the bad. The social media credit scores assigned to Chinese individuals and businesses categorize them on whether or not they're worthy of being part of society. A real name system, which requires people to use government-issued ID cards to buy mobile SIMs, obtain social media accounts, take a train, board a plane, or even buy groceries. All of these things, coupled with social media credit scores, ensures that those blacklisted as unworthy are banned from accessing financial markets, buying real estate, traveling by air or train. And among the activities that can get you labeled unworthy are taking reserve seats on trains or causing trouble in hospitals. In much the same way that Chinese products have infiltrated almost every market worldwide, altered consumer dynamics. China is now exporting its authoritarian tech to governments worldwide, ostensibly in an effort to spread its brand of totalitarianism worldwide. In fact, both China and the United States have led the way in supplying the rest of the world with AI surveillance, sometimes at a subsidized rate. This, my friends, is how totalitarianism conquers the world. With countries and authoritarian regimes that have been eager to adopt AI surveillance, as the Carnegie Endowment's research makes clear, liberal democracies are also aggressively using AI tools to police their borders, apprehend potential criminals, monitor citizens for bad behavior, and pull out suspected terrorists from crowds. And moreover, it's easy to see how the Chinese model for internet control has been integrated into the American police state's efforts to flush out so-called anti-government domestic extremists. According to journalist Adrian Shavatz's in-depth report, there are 9 elements to the Chinese model of digital authoritarianism when it comes to censoring speech and targeting activists. 1. Dissidents suffer from persistent cyber attacks and phishing. 2. Social media, websites, messaging apps would be blocked. 3. Posts that criticize government officials are removed. 4. Mobile and internet access are revoked as punishment for activism. 5. Paid commentators drown out government criticism. 6. New laws tighten regulations on online media. 7. Citizens' behavior is monitored via AI and surveillance tools. 8. Individuals regularly arrested for posts critical of the government. And 9. Online activists are made to disappear. How many broadcasters at this network alone would fit the mold for those 9 reasons? I mean, you don't even have to be a critic of the government to get snared in the web of digital censorship and AI surveillance. The danger posed by the surveillance state applies equally to all of us, lawbreaker and law abider alike. When the government sees and knows all and has an abundance of laws to render even the most seemingly upstanding citizen a criminal and a lawbreaker, then the old adage that you've got nothing to worry about if you've got nothing to hide no longer applies, my friends. And once again, in the words of Orwell, you had to live, did live, from habit that became instinct. In the assumption that every sound you made was overheard, and except in darkness, every movement scrutinized. My friends, in an age of too many laws, too many prisons, too many government spies, and too many corporations eager to make a fast buck at the expense of the American taxpayer, we are all guilty of some transgression or another. No one is spared. As Elise Thomas writes for Wired, new surveillance tech means you'll never be anonymous again. It won't be long before we find ourselves looking back on the past with longing, back to an age where we could speak to whomever we wanted, buy whatever we chose, think whatever we wanted, go wherever we wanted, feel whatever we wanted without those thoughts and words and activities being tracked and processed and stored by corporate giants. Were sold to government agencies and used against us by militarized police with their army of futuristic technologies. Tread cautiously, my friends. For 1984 has become an operation manual for the omnipresent modern-day AI surveillance state. But without constitutional protections in place to guard against encroachments on our rights when power, AI technology, and militaristic governance coverage. It won't be long before Philip K. Dick's rules for survival become our governing reality. In the words of Dick, if, as it seems, we are in the process of becoming a totalitarian society in which the state apparatus is all-powerful, the ethics most important for the survival of the true, free, human individual would be cheat, lie, evade, fake it, be elsewhere, forge documents, build improved electronic gadgets in your garage that'll outwit the gadgets used by the authorities. John W. Whitehead. Of all of Whitehead's columns that I have shared in both print and on the air, this is the most powerful I've ever been privileged to share. I'm going to publish it on Federal Observer tonight. And the way things are going on Federal Observer, who knows? I could be shut down at any moment. Think about it. This network could be shut down at any moment because of these type of commentaries, the truths, the realities of what's actually going on. Now, I am going to share something with you tonight that I have never done before on 20-odd years on the air. It's not uncommon for me to receive letters from listeners, sometimes letters from clients. But this one, I picked up the post office, I think a week ago Saturday, which means I would have picked that up on, I think I would have picked it up around the 16th, maybe a few days before of this month. And I began to read it. And I don't know if it was bored, if it just happened to catch me at the right time, but I put it down, put it back in the envelope, set it on my desk. Until several days ago. And I was bored about something, and I decided to open it and read it. I was surprised. I was shocked. And made a decision that I was going to share this letter with our listenership tonight. It's, to me, it's a mixed bag. Thursday nights, for whatever reason, are not generally our largest audience. For reasons I'm not going to bore you with. Something I'm not happy about, but it's what it is. The letter begins. Mr. Bennett, what a big soul you are, with a generosity of spirit I rarely run into. You blend the political, economic, and artistic with such a sensual and common sense approach. The common sense revealing itself in that one is hard pressed to disagree with you. Oh, yes, there are a few of the political points I see a bit differently, but these are better taken up in a cushioned lounge where soft club music is playing and our glasses are delivering truth boasts. As for the sensual, no one delivers a personally loving song quite like you do. It's as if each of those songs was your personal story and you coax the listener to come into the song's story. Have a look around. Maybe merge with some sentiments being served. And often I have found myself caught in the depths of those melodic human revelations because I was invited by you to consider what was being served. I love you, the letter continues. Now that's, I think, what spooked me about the first time I started reading this and I saw this and said, uh-oh. But then as I did, I picked it up a few days later to continue to read the entire thing. And the letter continues, and I guess I'm writing because I want you to love me back. But you already do. And of course, I'm referring to a love above the sweet attractions that sweep us away. No, those don't last, she says. This love is spiked with the experience of you having been around the block many, many times, and down an alleyway or two, or even out of the red carpet, a celebrity, and yet an everyman. I tell my husband what Jeffrey gave me today. We walk out to buy some silver, or we spend an afternoon with Ayn Rand, and we try harder to take in Grok. Really enjoy jazz, or we decide to avoid cancer forever. Knowing Dr. Kelly had to go down the rabbit hole where few go. And one day you played Waylon doing Dreaming My Dreams. And I waltzed with you. And we knew each other. Waylon's purity of soul lifted us beyond ourselves. A man of grit capable of such tenderness. He's such a metaphor for our world. Crazy. Struggle. Yet achingly beautiful. An outlaw's holy man, not without demons. I hardly trust anyone who doesn't know about demons. And the letter continues, I only found you recently, though I know you've been out there for years, giving yourself to reach any who might be reachable, throwing a rope to suffering humanity. What finesse do you bring to this, even when you share your colonoscopy story? You give it a place in evolution, almost putting it on a par with ballet or fine architecture. I've never been so interested in something I hardly ever thought about. I would not make this too long, so I'll close by saying I was compelled to write you. As my nature, I will then disappear like most groupies should. I have 3/4 of a century under my belt, but, sir, I've never seen the likes of you. A gift to us, I must say. An unexpected radio philosopher, an eclectic disc jockey with polished taste, a salesman extraordinaire, one so very, very easy to trust. But above all, a survivor. Even when life throws dirt, disappointment, or pain. So much to say about your personality, suave intelligence, too much to say about your character, salt of the earth, yet refined, uncompromising, and ever able to walk in the other guy's shoes. Lately, I absolutely appreciate and respect how you see the giant in so many people, even everyday people like your nurse or your daughter-in-law, making almost everyone a bit of the great-grandson of Charles Dickens. I'm sure it helped me see the giant in my own self. No, not every day, but here and there. And if I keep listening to the shows, I'll see it every day. Because that's what you're prompting. Myself? I celebrate those who make my head nod in assent and who often bring epiphany. They and the Bill of Rights ignite my soul and assure it's not only free, but spiritually, mentally, and aesthetically fed. Thank you, sir, for doing that. Feeding. Ever feeding. Take care, Mr. Bennett. May you be well and live a long, long time in that wellness, and in spite of a world gone wrong, one that we just have to fix. None of your efforts are wasted, but are falling upon fertile ground. You make us better. Without apology, and with much regret, appreciation, and affinity. Signed, Galen. If you're out there listening tonight, I think you have no idea how much this letter affected me. It affected me greatly when I read it. It has affected me even greater now that I've read it live on the air. And that's something I don't do. I receive a lot of letters. But this one affected me. I thank you for that. Maybe at a time in my life when so much is bothering me. In some respects, health issues. In other respects, family issues. In other respects, so much of the kind that we shared with John Whitehead's column tonight. So much of what some of these other writers and friends submit to Kettle Moraine Publications. The continual conversations that I have with Charles Dickens, Justin. I don't talk to people as much anymore as I once did. I don't interact with humanity the way I once did. I have withdrawn in so many respects. My time on the air to talk with you listeners, that is in so many respects more important to me. Hoping that I can make a difference in your lives, in the way you think, the way you pray, the way you act within your community, with your own families. It will be people like us that can make a difference in this world. More importantly, that must make a difference in this world, people. I have shared with you often the story of when I took my last caller on a broadcast quite some years ago. My program followed John Stadtmiller's. John would at least once a month or more often get on his program and rant and rave about the need for financial support for the network. And on this one particular day, he was angry. And he got angrier and angrier. We all know John. John had this way of doing that. And basically made the state, didn't basically, I know the exact words that John used, talking to his audience, that if you people don't support this network, I'm just going to shut the goddamn thing down. And those were John's exact words that day. And he went on and ranted and raved for the rest of his program. Well, he also decided that he didn't want to go on the air live the next day and face his audience. And asked if I would fill in for him. I've never been one to take callers. There are some extremely good callers that I've taken. Some extremely good guests, although I rarely do that anymore, that I've dealt with over the years. And, of course, John's program right away opens up people wanting to call in. They all wanted to voice their opinion. I did what I had to do for the first hour. Second hour, I started taking some calls, one or two calls. And the second or third call came in. And the man's comment was, Well, I don't know what in the hell we all going to do if we shut the network down. I listen 12, 14 hours a day. And that was his accent. I'm good at accents, okay? And I said, why do you listen that often? Why do you listen that many hours a day? Why are you not making a difference in your own community, in this nation? Find those programs that have got the strongest position in what they're talking about and what they're trying to guide you to do. You shouldn't be listening more than 6 hours a day. Find those strong programs that can make that kind of a difference in your life. Don't tune in to be entertained. And now you must begin to make a difference within the confines of your own family, number one. And step outside the front door. Get to know your neighbors. And Jesus, my God, talk intelligently, would you? And find out where your neighbors stand on issues. Be it education, be it your school board, your city council. Start making a difference right where you live. Because if you don't, and if the listeners don't, we're not going to be able to make one damn bit of difference in this country, people. And because the American people haven't done it, they've sat back and, I shall politely say, taken it in the assets. That's A-S-S-E-T-S. You make out of that what you wish. Because if we don't make a difference within our family and locally, within our own community, and then the county, and then the state, and wherever, and through our letters, and our emails, and our trips across the country to visit our relatives and families, or whatever the case may happen to be, then we're never going to be able to make that difference. And we will lose. And I'm afraid we are losing. I am afraid we are losing. Because people aren't doing it. They're just sitting back saying there isn't a damn thing we can do, so they're not even bothering. Does that make sense? Look, I don't agree with every broadcaster that's on this network. And I'm sure there are those who won't agree with the thing that I stand for or talk about or say or whatever the case may be. It's okay. But there's got to be a point where there's some agreement, some understanding of what's taking place, what we can all do to make a difference, to make that change. Makes me want to close with Michael Jackson. Yeah, I do a wide range of music, a massively wide range of music, because every one of those stinking songs, in most cases that we will play, or pieces of music, say something. I mean, that was the oddball the other day, Tuesday night, opening up with Ricky Nelson. I can't even remember what the heck, what we played. Poor Little Fools? I don't even remember what we did. I can't even remember what song it was. But it struck me right then and there. It had to be open. Fools Rush In. Thank you, Mike. Fools Rush In. Where wise men never tread. Does that make sense to you people? Do you begin to understand why along come Friday, I'm fed up with talking about all this ugliness. You're tired of hearing it. Whether it's health, whether it's politics, whether it's, doesn't matter what the subject matter is, economics, who cares? Now, I have nothing prepared for tomorrow night. But I've got a program coming up sometime, I pray God, in the next couple of weeks. a musical program for Friday that's going to be a mind blower. I talked to Mike about it tonight. He loves the sound of it. I'm not going to tease you with it. You're going to have to wait. Yeah, I love jazz. But there's a lot of other kind of music so like. I like old country. Most of this new stuff ain't country at all. But I love Miranda Lambert. She's good. We're reaching the final days of people like George Strait. Alan Jackson's not in great health. In a great video they did several years ago talking about the death of country music. It says so much. I look back at the music I was raised with. Opera. Jazz. Yeah. Singers some of you people have never heard of. I was into Sammy Davis as a young kid. And I grew with him. And I saw him live several times. An amazing entertainer, an amazing talent. Far greater talent than Sinatra and Dean Martin had combined. And I enjoy both Dean Martin and Sinatra. I've not made it plain. I'm not a fan of Andy Williams, okay? Perry Comer, different guy. I hope you will continue to stay with us. Yes, I ask you to support the network. The network is doing all they can right now to make some changes, some positive changes, to make a difference. I hope that we're going to see some new broadcasters. That's not a negative comment about any others that are here. Because I've made it very plain and clear, I don't listen to other broadcasters. I never have. I'm not saying that I'm better. It's just I am me. I do what I do. I don't want to copy other people. I don't want to talk about the same things that other people talk about. I've made this very clear to each and every one of you. So this last 20-odd minutes of this program, with the exception of the letter from Galen, is not what I anticipated doing tonight. But that letter from her just took me down a different path. If I bored you, I'll not apologize for it. As you know, that most nights when I close the program, I close by stating without apology. She chose to use that statement in her closing line in her letter as well. These are things to think about, my friends. I hope that there's things out of this program tonight that affected each and every one of you, not just the words of Whitehead, but the words of Galen, not because she spoke to me or about me, but because the things she raised, the questions she raised. Go back and listen to the archive of this program again. Tonight, tomorrow night, whatever. Pass it on to others so they may listen as well. And maybe we can make a difference. Without apology, I am Jeffrey Bennett. Do you think we have time? Do you think we have time? These are the days of the open hand. We will not be the last. Look around now. These are the days of the beggars and the choosers. This is the year of the hungry man, whose place is in the past. Hand in hand with ignorance and legitimate excuses, the rich
declare themselves poor, and most of us are not sure if we have it too much, but we're taking our chances, say. I sang 20 years and a day, but nothing changed. The human race found some other guy and walked into the flame. It's hard to love, there's so much to hate. Hanging on to hope when there is no hope to speak out. Wounded skies above say it's much too late. Then maybe we should all be praying for time. Do you think we have Do you think we have time? These are the days of the empty hand. Oh, we hold on to what you can. And charity, charity is the coat you wear twice a year. This is the year of the guilty man. Your television takes a stand, and you find that what was over there is over here. So you scream from behind your door, say what's mine is mine and not yours. I may have too much, but I'll take my chances, say. I sang it 20 years and a day, 'cause nothing changed. The human race found some other guy and walked into the flames. It's hard to love, Jesus has so much to hate. Hanging on to hope, there is no hope to speak out. Skies above say it's much too late. Then maybe we should all be praying for time.
Standing 6'4", weighing in 245 pounds of crime-fighting, political science-analyzing brawn, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Patrick Slattery.
So, Mike, get off this anti-cicada agenda.
I'm a born-again traditional Christian, and my favorite possessions are right here on my nightstand. That would be the King James Bible and my .357 revolver.
I'd rather be ruled by Chinamen than Jews.
Cool it with the anti-Semitic remarks, right?
Just because you steal an election and terminate the republic doesn't mean you terminate the people in the republic, because we're still here.
I'm not taking the vaccine. F*** you, Bill Gates.
There was a way forward still on January 6th. What needed to be done is to object to every single state.
The COVID-19 virus was the setup. The vaccine could very well be the bioweapon.
The Patrick and Jeremy Show, Tuesday at 9 Central. And Wednesday at 1 Central.
You can't handle the truth.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit republicbroadcasting.org today, because you can handle the truth.